Welcome back to The Bookshelf. I'm Caleb Mannin, continuing the reading of my 2015 novel, Bust It Like a Mule, The Tale of Cotton Kingfisher. Chapter 20. While Jael is soaking his wound, she touches some of his scars, so as he won't know, but she touches them to know his story, and she feels something inside her at all those scars, especially the Tillamook burn one, and she touches it tender like she wishes she could heal it all up. At some point while Jael is nursing and touching bare-chested cotton, the police captain comes home to find his one and only daughter patching up the goddamn slaughterhouse drifter in his own by-God bathroom with yellow walls and pictures of birds and landscapes, and his head nearly explodes. For Cotton has seen a man's head explode, by God, though he does not ever want to discuss it, and it looks pretty close to the way the captain's head is getting. "What in the hell is going on here?" the captain shouts, and he ain't asking, he is telling. And Jael acts like nothing is going on here and stands and brushes past her daddy, and they go into the kitchen, and there is a big shouting match wherein she tells her daddy how men tried to abuse her and blame Cotton, and he won't believe it. Cotton stays in the bathroom a piece, just smoking and looking at that pretty picture Jael painted all by herself. Then he throws his shirt over his shoulder and heads out the door, stopping in the kitchen doorway to say, "I better head back, Jael. Thank you for your kindness." And she says, "You don't have to go." And he says, "The hell I don't," pointing at her daddy's gun on his belt. And the captain looks all offended like, "How dare you say I would shoot an unarmed man? I am a damn officer of the goddamn law." But he and Cotton both know that Cotton is the most dangerous unarmed man they have ever seen, and that damn officer of the goddamn law has the prettiest daughter in all the mountains, so all bets are off. "I am not done with you yet, Kingfisher," the captain hollers after him, but Cotton don't give a damn as he is done. And when he is done, he is gone. And he is done, so he is gone. Don't matter the man telling him he ain't done. He climbs in the truck and heads on back to the cabin and drinks whiskey and gets hard drunk all alone, but not before he barricades the doors and windows just in case and wraps himself in his Indian blanket, his favorite possession, and drifts off to the Big Rock Candy going to the Sun Mountains with Jael riding them like a painted pony on the plains. Monday at roll call, Fred Mason is missing some of his crew, and Terry is jittery-like he had too much coffee and cigarettes, and Cotton is sore as all hell, but he won't let on, by God, so Mason says nothing as he hands out jobs and they set to work. Cotton wants to give Terry a smile from ear to ear, which Cotton knows from his daddy means to slit his throat for hiring men to come and beat him, and not coming himself, but he wants to keep his land where the world began, job, so he bides his time, and this may be the first time this has ever happened to him that he knows of. The Stumptown folks are all talking about a bloody mess of a fight at the Grange after the dance, and Cotton hears somehow that he had left by then, so it could not have been him, and he is mighty obliged to Jael for not spilling the beans, though he never needed no woman to stick up for him, and he wonders how she is keeping her daddy's 10-star yap shut. Cotton tells Jacob Two Calves about the whole thing, and Jacob says, "You should be careful. It sounds like they want you out bad." And Cotton says, "Damn it, son, they can't chase me out of the land where the world began. No, sir, just let them try, by God." And Jacob is afraid, for he knows they will try again. And he worries for his wild white friend, for Jacob is earthwise and knows the darkness like a dog gone bad waiting to bite that lays in all men's hearts, be they red or white. Cotton and Jacob work on a landslide area in the mountains, digging away, and Cotton hears an engine shaker rattlesnake too late, and that cotton-picking sidewinder takes a swipe at him, but it glances off of Cotton's brand-new stiff work pants, and Jacob shouts for him to look out, and Cotton jumps up and sideways like he was in a goddamn cartoon, and lands a few feet away from the winder, but get this. Even Jacob is amazed when Cotton don't run, but goes after that by God rattler, reaches real quick-like behind and grabs it by the tail and snaps it up, then brings it down like a bull whip, cracking, crushing its head on a rock. Jacob is a little rattled, no pun intended, but Cotton just smiles and he holds up the snake and hollers, "Well, I guess we know what's for supper," and it was, by God. What Jacob didn't know and what I am telling you now is that his wild white friend has always been snake-catching crazy, and some men say this is from his daddy beating on him and made him wild like that, and some men say his daddy beat on him on account of his being wild like that, but I suppose it is both and neither, for Cotton was always just wall-eyed buck wild. He would catch snakes like that there rattler with his bare hands as a boy, goddamn copperheads, I tell you, while his little brother clambered up into a tree and hollered down at him, "God dang it, Cotton, daddy is gonna whoop you." But Cotton didn't care none, by God, and he'd keep handling them there snakes. Cotton would keep them cotton-picking copperheads in a crate cage he made until once his drunk-ass daddy found them out, and I will be damned if his drunk-ass daddy did not grab a copperhead by its tail, just like his son Cotton. But he was not catching, he was killing, and he slung it up against a tree like a whip, just like Cotton did with that there rattler busting its skull. Cotton would get powerful angry at his daddy in those times and pray to God that the snakes would bite him and kill him deader than a doornail. But they never did, and this is one of the reasons Cotton has an grievance with God, for God never answered even that simplest little prayer. Jacob Two Calves made a necklace for Cotton from the rattle of the rattler on a leather string, and he said it would bring Cotton good luck, and also they could use it to find out if there was other rattlers about when they were in the rocks. And this is why Cotton wears that rattler necklace on his neck to this day. Mason stops by the cabin later that week and asks if Cotton is okay and if he was involved in the Grange fight, though he knows goddamn good and well he was by the list of injuries, such as broken jaws and shoulders unhinged from chest cages and a goddamn man hanging in a tree like a bar brawl crucifix. And Cotton says, "Do you want the truth or the not truth?" And Fred Mason says, "Neither, damn it. But Cotton, I like you, so be careful. I can't figure out why Captain Carter hasn't bothered me about it, being as you're all my employees, but he hasn't. But stay out of trouble now, you hear?" And Cotton says he does hear, and Mason tells Jacob Two Calves to keep his eye on the Fireline Okie, and Jacob says nothing but nods his head. And Cotton says to Mason to tell the family hi, and after Mason goes, Cotton laughs, but Jacob doesn't, so Cotton says, "Why so down in the mouth, brother?" But Jacob Two Calves won't say, so they play cards and drink buck whiskey, then sleep in their Indian blankets. But Jacob barricades the door and windows, just in case. Not 2 days later, as Cotton and Jacob are playing cards, trying to stay out of trouble like Mason told them, they hear a car pull up and they hide their whiskey, but not their cards. And someone knocks on the cabin door, and Cotton sees that beautiful dancing JL girl through the screen, and his heart gets going like a jackhammer that he would know he's run them in the cities, for he is always the strongest man on the crew. "You better get inside before Mason sees you," Cotton says, and he pulls her inside, even though it ain't really proper. And Jacob Two Calves says he will go out for an evening stroll, and I will be damned if he didn't, though I will tell you this and not Cotton, is that Jacob went a piece from the cabin and hid in the trees and watched the cabin and smoked to look out for his buck white friend. Standing there together in the cabin a little too close, Cotton thinks JL smells like wildflowers and the sun, and JL thinks Cotton smells like the smoky earth and the weavings of whiskey, and this suits both of them just fine. So they stand too close, quiet like this for a bit, getting high off each other's fumes. Chapter 21. "I brought you something," JL says, and hands Cotton a brown paper bag package, and Cotton says, "What's this?" "Open it," JL replies, so he opens it, and it is a rustic pottery coffee mug, but fired all nice and glossy with a deep blue sky color going brown, and it reminds Cotton of them mountains all around, and JL says, "It's a coffee mug I made for you. Do you like it?" And it means the world to Cotton that she gave him this here mug, for no one has given him anything so kind as something they made with their own bare hands, especially a woman, especially such a pretty one at that, and he imagines her slender, pretty, fingernail-painted fingers working the mug into something he will put to his mouth every day, and he nearly can't speak, but he can, so he says, "That's mighty nice of you, and good work, too. I told you I did pottery. There is a sun and such on it for the land where the world began, like you are always going on about, and your name, too." "That is something to see, Jael, girl. I don't think I ever got a nicer gift." And Jael is happy, for she sees that he means what he says, though he is trying to be a man about it, and she don't care if he is a man about it, damn it, just as long as he likes it, and she can see he does like it. Cotton makes up some coffee, and they sit at the table and have some black joe with whiskey, and it is oh so smooth, but stout enough it'll put hair on your chest. And Cotton stares at this girl, for she's pretty in a red scarf and her hair, in denim jeans and a work shirt with rolled-up sleeves showing bronzed arms all speckled with clay, like she just came fresh from throwing his mug and going to the Sun Woman Jael, starts to look mighty fine. Finer than usual, which is a lot, by God, I will tell you, and I know that this is the prettiest girl Cotton has ever seen. "How come no one has come to raise Cain on me since the Grange brawl?" Cotton asks, and the girl, she says, "I let into my dad about the town being crooked and all. He was mad about it, but what could he do? He couldn't call me a liar, and I spread the word I got jumped and you saved me. Dad had to go clean up the whole thing. I think he might be seeing the light of day in all this, and that you're not so bad after all." "Well, I'm mighty obliged to you for sticking up for me, not that I need it, by God." "Of course not," Jael says with a smile. Cotton goes on, "But I'll believe that when I see it about your daddy. He went and talked to Terry, and Terry said he didn't have anything to do with it." "That dog don't hunt with me, that little runt," Cotton goes off, and Jael laughs. And he has never had someone laugh at his being angry, so he sips his whiskey, coffee, and smacks his lips and says, "Well, I'm serious, by God. That little liar, if he comes near me, I will kill him with my bare hands, so help me God." "Why haven't you killed him with your bare hands yet?" Jael asks, and Cotton says, "I don't know. I guess I reckon I like this place, and I like this job, and the earth has been pretty kind to me around here, and I don't want to make no trouble for Boss Mason. He's been real good to me." "That's pretty big for a cuss like you," Jael says, and she smiles, white teeth and all, and Cotton crooked grins in spite of himself, for she is teasing him, and he ain't never liked being teased, but she has always been able to get away with it since the first day he laid eyes on her big sky, big sun, faded red dress in the dog leg. "The people in town are all talking about you," she goes on, "about the dance and how you were such a hoot." "Are they? Well, I'll be a monkey's uncle." "I think that's part of it, is the town is starting to turn in your favor. I can't figure why." "There's just something about you, Cotton," Jael smiles, and Cotton likes the way she says this, like there really is something about him that would make people be on his side when he has always been the outsider. "Even the minister was talking about you." "The hell you say." "Yes," and Jael laughs at his expressionism. "He was talking about you being a smart man or something, but maybe a bit touchy." Then Cotton goes on about how that sweet little minister character is always sneaking up behind him as he minds his own business on the church bench, and Jael finds it amusing, and he tells her about how the rattler tried to kill him the other day when she asks about his necklace, and he asks her about pottery and Montana and painting. They talk and talk about nothing, and Cotton has never really cared about a woman so much to talk and talk about nothing. No disrespect to all the others, and Cotton would mean no disrespect to them, but this is just the truth. Then they head out for Jael to get back in her car and go home, and she says, "I am sorry I misjudged you." And he says, "Did you?" And she says, "Yes, when you first came into town. Maybe I'd have thought different about you if you and Terry had a square dancing contest instead of a boxing match that day." And Cotton curses at the ridiculous idea, and she says, "Oh, I wanted to tell you about the sun on your mug I made you. Inside of the sun there is a war club and a peace pipe. That's what those things are, in case you were wondering." And he wasn't, but now he is, and she says, "You know, because you're a warrior who is making peace with the earth." And Cotton thinks this sounds like what the minister said to him that one day, but it does not make him angry this time. It makes so much goddamn horse sense that he looks down on big sky, big moon, yonder woman, Jail, standing right in front of him, and he does something he ain't never. And it is that he leans down and kisses JL on her neck, under a jawbone that runs graceful like the deer upon the plains, even though it ain't proper. And he hears her catch a breath like a trout out of water when he does this, and his cheek rasps hers. Then he says, "Good night," and he turns and goes back inside. It is a while before JL's car starts up, then she is gone. And when Jacob Two Calf comes back in the cabin, he finds Cotton lying on his back on his bed, staring up at the ceiling, and Jacob says, "Good night, Cotton Kingfisher." And Cotton says, "Good night, Jacob Two Calves," and they sleep in peace. Busted Like a Mule, Chapter 22. There is a small fire in the North Mountains that Jacob and Cotton go to put out by taking a rough service road and come down on top of it and cut it off before it gets out of hand. It is a big enough blaze that they need several crews, and Terry and his boys are working it, and Cotton is in charge of them all. Cotton is heaving and hacking and sweating in the old man big sun in the big heat of the blaze, shirtless and shining. Though he is not supposed to be shirtless, he don't care none, because it is hotter than old Blicky's, and his shirt bout rubs him raw. So Cotton is heaving and hacking, and he gets mighty bothered that when he looks on down the line, he sees that Terry kid busting it like a mule with him, and he gets mad he has to share a line with that pissant, but there is nothing to be done for it. When they have beat the fire and they stand in the char smoking, Cotton gets all fired up and goes over to Terry and his crew, though Jacob tells him no. Terry stands when he sees Cotton coming, for no man wants to be sitting when Cotton Kingfisher is on top of you, and besides, he looks like a bronze-scarred big sun god shining shirtless coming through the smoke. Terry throws his chest out, and Cotton marches up right in front of him, and Terry is taller than he. Cotton ain't too tall, just under 6 feet, and Terry is just over, but they both know who is by God stronger, and it isn't the tallest man standing on this charred strip of mountain flesh. "Nice work today, kid," Cotton says, and Terry is a bit surprised, and he says, "Thank you," though his jawbone is clenched like a snap wolf trap, and Cotton goes on, "Nicer than when you sent your boys to shit me up. I know you tried to kill me and hurt the girl and pin it on me that night after the dance, you little sh—" And Terry flinches and his eyebrow twitches, and his crew pick up their shovels like weapons, but they also back away. But Terry says, "I don't know what you are talking about." Cotton says, "The hell you don't. By God, don't piss down my back and call it rain." And the mountain goes quiet as a goddamned grave. Not even a bird is singing now, and the smoke is still rising up a bit, and the big sky sun is hell hot, and it feels like they are in Devil's Half Acre. And he goes on, "Let me tell you something, boy. If you think that boxing match was bad, you ain't seen what I can dish out, by God. Unless, I guess you did, you saw your boys put in the hospital by me." And Terry says, "I don't know what you mean, Mr. Kingfisher," real loud-like so the others will hear him, but it is warbly scared, and no one gives a good goddamn. They wish Terry would just run and not bring the house down on them with himself. "The hell you don't, you little sh—. Don't ever come near me again, you hear?" And Terry is standing up straight like he stood up straight in the Navy, staring past Cotton's shoulder like he stared over his officer's shoulder in the Navy, and Cotton finishes, "And stay away from the girl." Then Terry loses his cool. Lord love him, though the men around him try to shush his fool damn mouth while he shouts, "Who the hell do you think you are? You stay away from her, you old bull." And Cotton just turns and walks off through the black land as Terry shouts after him, and the others try to shut up his fool damn mouth. "She isn't yours. You stay away from her," Terry yells as Cotton and Jacob drive off in the truck. Jacob reaches over and rattles the rattler rattle on Cotton's neck, and Cotton lets him, and Jacob does it, and Cotton doesn't ask why, and Jacob never says why, but they both know why. Cotton stands outside the cabin and smokes, and he feels the wind is starting to blow fire season black feet wind in full bloom. But what about after the fire season work is over? Where will he go? And he does not know. He has not even thought about wandering for a long while, and he cannot believe himself for this, and he almost gets riled at himself, but then he doesn't, by God, because he is happier than a hog on ice here, and he don't know if he has ever been happy, just high like a kite in the wind that will always come down. But right now, he feels like a jet plane tearing up above, just looking down, all content with a full belly and a happy heart. He thinks on his family, and for the first time, not really, but the first time he will admit it to himself, he thinks he wishes he could bust it like a mule on the same line with his little brother. And he thinks about him and his brother and Jacob Two Calves busting it on the same line, sweating together, then looking up at one another with smoke-smudged faces and smiling, for life is good. He also thinks that he and Jael would be married, and they would go to the Masons, and all the children would play, and he and Mason would drink beer and wrestle the children and his brother. Then he would go home and lay next to Jael in bed he bought with his government money that he earned himself with his own damn hands. And she would be warm and in a frilly get-up. And here is where the dream sort of breaks down into Jael sexy thoughts. I will leave those thoughts for Cotton, for you by God know those thoughts are sacred, even to Cotton, whose story I am telling. For I ain't trying to tell it all like those thoughts of Jael, but I bet they were beautiful thoughts, for she is a goddamn beautiful woman that old man made from the Montana earth and rib of man. She is so pretty, Cotton figures when he thinks of her, that it aches like the ache of a bullet in the body. And Cotton would know, for he has had a bullet in the body. And she aches like that, only on the end of the ache there is a sweet pain like whiskey, not like his real bullet holes that just ache on cold nights and rainy days. Cotton does not know this, but I do, and I am sure you do too by now, that Jael plucks his strings, and not the mean ones, just the good ones. And she has set them to humming from head to heart to rib. On the weekend, Jacob goes home to the res to see his family, but before he goes, he says, "Don't get into trouble," and Cotton says, "I am trouble." And they always say that, but Cotton is joking, and Jacob Two Calves is not. Or I guess neither of them is joking, now that I come to think of it. Cotton heads on down to the lake, where there is a touristy lodge, and where Mason is bringing his family for a picnic. So Cotton heads on down with a cooler full of beer and hamburgers and whatnot, and he finds the Masons down by the lake picnicking like a bunch of sun children, not a care in the by God world. Elsa Mason is a mighty fine woman in her yellow swimsuit and campfire red hair and sunglasses and bare white shoulders and long white legs. And Fred Mason is a handsome devil in navy swim trunks, and the kids are looking happy and sunbaked, and when Cotton comes up, they call him Mr. Cotton, and he likes it, for it ain't too formal. There are other locals and campers and tourists down at the beach, and it is one fine damn party in the sun, but the water is so glacier cold, it grabs you by the balls and won't let go. And the Mason boys run back and forth, jumping in, then running out and toweling off. And Mason and Cotton laugh at them and drink beer while Elsa lies on a towel and reads her magazines. After a few beers, Cotton hops on into the water and whoo-yee. Boy, it is colder than a well digger's ass. But he dares the boys to stay in with him, and they do, by God, while Fred watches from the shore. And Cotton picks up the boys and throws them, and they splash down like incoming shells in the water and come up laughing and coughing, for it is so cold. Cotton is careful with the boys, for their slippery limbs feel so fragile he fears he will break them. And he wonders if he was this brittle as a boy, and if so, how did his daddy not break him, though he guessed he did. Then Mason comes in, and he's a goddamn Navy man, so he skims under the water like a torpedo, then grabs Cotton's legs, and they wrestle a bit and play, for Mason knows Cotton can beat the ever-loving hell out of him, but he wants to show the man he is his friend and not an enemy, and Cotton likes it, by God, like wrestling with his little brother, and he takes it easy on his friend boss. Then the boys head back into the shore, and Cotton and Mason stay up to their chests and look up at the mountains that feed the lake with glacier water, and both men wonder, though neither man says, what will become of them, for this is what them big sky mountains do to a man's thoughts. Then Elsa calls him back on in for burgers and beer, and they grapple one another some more. And the kids laugh when Cotton picks Mason up and drags him back to shore, and Mason shouts, "I let him do that." And the kids say it ain't so, and Cotton winks at him, for they all know it ain't. The little Mason girl goes and brings Cotton an extra towel, for he didn't bring his own, he is that callous-skinned, by God. And he is much obliged by her kindness and the kindness of this family, and maybe, by God, just maybe, the kindness of mankind. For if little ones are so kind to a broke-down, mean old, ornery cuss drifter like himself, then maybe there is hope for the rest of us all, dear Lord. That's all for tonight. You've been hearing my novel, Busted Like a Mule. I'm Caleb Manon, and have a heap of help from Mike Ailman and Vern Windham, who recorded and edited it. It is a production of Spokane Public Radio for The Bookshelf. Busted Like a Mule is available on Amazon and Kindle. It is also at some libraries as well as major booksellers, including Auntie's, of course, oh, and the author's front porch. For original music and more about the book, visit CalebManon.com. Catch you next time. If you've missed any of the episodes, head over to kpbx.org to hear the podcast.